Indie Media Global Report on Resonance FM 104.4. Check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
In a democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population, have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
All before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome.
It's time to talk about censorship.
I'm in the village of Marder, which is near the village of Salfeet. Both villages are in the West Bank, and as this is for a London audience, you won't know, listeners, where this is. But it's in a very beautiful part of Palestine. There's hills, green fields. I came to this village today because there's a permaculture course going on in the village of Marder, and I've met with a man here who I think has organised this course.
Murad Al-Kufash.
And what's your job?
I'm the director of Marder Permaculture Farm.
So you're the director of Marder Permaculture. Why do you think permaculture is important for Palestine?
You know, in my opinion, permaculture, maybe for somebody is new, but for us is an old thing. So we, like our people, like generation after generation, they used to deal with this kind of techniques. Like they used to have their farms, they have animals, so they live in the land, not like having job from different country. So I got learned about permaculture, and my first aim or my first target for the project is to encourage the people in my country and my village or around the village or the whole country to encourage them to come back to the land and start planting and growing their own vegetables or their own trees or their own fruits. So they will be in one day hopefully in the coming time, they will be more independent. No need to go to work in Israel or to depend about the market from outside. So they will save more money and they will be more healthy, because we talk about organic food, no chemicals, no pesticides, no hybrid seeds. It's only things we have it in our hands, and no need to spend money just to bring things from outside. So that's my point. And the farm will be like for teaching, and it will be like a non-profit. So we got to teach the people. And we show them what we talk about, like we explain to them, and we show them, because we have the model here, the site. It's about 2 dunam and 200 meters square. We go design the garden, and we show the farmers what we talk about. So when they come here, they will look. So if you see something, you can stuck in your mind more than if you hear something. So the model will be just for the people to see what we talk about. And they will go back to their house, and they start doing this in their own gardens or their own backyard. This is in the beginning. Or this is in the first, like, small scale. But in the future, we will be, like, doing in a big scale. So from the house garden, we go to the big field. So we'll have all our land full with the fruit trees, vegetables, everything. Hopefully, we will reach a time we will be a self-sufficiency.
As a foreigner in Palestine, it looks to me like people grow things all over Palestine anyway and are really brilliant at managing their land, because it's quite difficult to take care of water in Palestine, isn't it?
Through permaculture, we have something, we talk about the water, how can deal with the water, how we harvest water. You have different techniques. You have the grey water system. So, like in the house, we spend like 80-85 from the water.
Could you tell our listeners what grey water is? Because they won't know.
Grey water system is like the water comes from the sink or from the hand wash or from the shower only, not the toilet. So it's not the black water. We talk about the grey water. So if you connect this water in one pipe and you take it to the garden and you build a special design in your garden, so that means you will have a wet area for 24/7. You have a wet area there, so you could irrigate your plants or your vegetables or your trees. But we have rules for this, like not to grow any leaves, vegetables that we use the leaves from it, like parsley or mint or something like that. So you could use the eggplant, cauliflower, potato, peanuts, something like that, not the leaves. That in this case, you will save money, because anyway you're spending the money and you just dump it anywhere, so you save water, and you save the deep water by get polluted from this water mixed with the sewage, and you could use the roof to collect water. So if you have a cistern tank in your house or in your garden, you could collect water come from raining or from the valley during the winter, and especially like in, we have an example in Marda, we have the spring. And the spring running a lot of water, a huge amount of water every year, from especially in winter time. So if we have the chance to build or to have like different kinds of cistern tanks in the area, we could fill them in water, and we could use the water in the winter, in the summertime, for the summer crops.
Are there any problems from collecting rainwater? Are you allowed to collect rainwater here?
Yeah, we got no problem to collect rainwater, because nobody can stop us with this. It's rainwater. So it's in my house, so, and it's my roof water, come from my roof. And the water from the spring is in the village, so nobody can, until now we got no problem with this. But you never know the occupation, what we'll do in the future. Maybe they will kick us from the village itself, so everything be, there's a chance for everything from the occupation. But so our job, or my fight, is to help my people to connect and to put themselves in the land back, to in the land again, not to leave the land, because that's what's happening since we got the occupation. People, they start leaving the land because they look for more money for their life, because, you know, everything is one up, and the money that they have to get from the land start being not enough. And as example, the olive oil. Olive oil is very expensive. It's very nice. It's a good product, or it's like the economy for the country. But unfortunately, we surrounding the country surrounding by different people, like from the borders country or from Israel. So we cannot, it's not allowed to us to export our olive oil outside, like to England or to America. And if we get the chance to do something like this, we have the traders, they cheat the people, and they took the olive oil with a cheap price. That's why people, most of the people, they start leaving the fields and leaving their lands to try to get money by working in Israel, as example, or leaving the country to go to another place like America or Europe or whatever.
So you see that this kind of project is going to give Palestinians hope?
Yeah. In my opinion, this will give them a hope, because we give them the knowledge how to deal with the things is in between your hand already. No need to bring something from outside. The garden, we have the garden. The plants or the seeds, we have the seeds. So we're going to organize how to do these things, how to put it in one place and special technique to give you the benefit. And for fertilizing the soil, we have the things from our kitchen waste. So we dump it in the garbage? No, we can put it back in the garden. So everything is inside the house. Nothing coming from outside.
How long have you been involved in this project?
I'm involved in permaculture in total about since 1993, but I worked for 5 years in a first project we used to have in Merda, but this project is finished, no more, and I left the country for 5 years, then I come back and I start working in this site, building the site, because it was just a land, no, it's no border, no fence, nothing, no terracing, so I built the whole thing and I started doing the designing the garden, like since from this summer I started designing gardens into the site. So it's about, in permaculture, it's about 17 years, I think. You could say 17 years, right, I think. Since 93 until now, it's 2008. So 8, and it's 15 years. Yeah.
So, and what things are you growing?
What things? Everything. Vegetables, fruit, trees, legume trees, shade trees, everything. Everything is because in the design you could bring anything in the same place, but you know we had to know what exactly this one doing for the other one, so there's no competition. They will help each other as a companion plant or companion trees. So that's the idea.
How did you first learn about permaculture?
My first learn in 1993. We, as I said, we used to have a permaculture site in the village, and it's run by Ma'an Development Center. So this project here was as a branch for Ma'an Development Center from Ramallah. And we have the first design course by Julie Firth and Mike Fingold from England and Julie Firth from Australia. So I got my first BDC. And then I got another BDC while I was working there. By running that BDC was run by Peter from Crystal Water and Barbara Knudsen. She's from Crystal Water too. Then I got my diploma from the Permaculture Institute in Australia. And I worked in the site here in the village for that until 1998. Then I quit the job for different reasons. And in 2001, I left the country to America to work and to learn. So I got both chances. I work in Chicago and I learn in Tennessee at the farm, at the GVI, Global Village Institute.
Do you think permaculture will help Palestinians survive the occupation?
By fighting the occupation, yeah. That's my fight, as I said. Because as soon as I got succeed to connect the people to the land, that means we'll be more time in the land.
Could you tell me, what is your favorite permaculture project?
What is my favorite permaculture project? My project.
And what is the best thing about your project?
The best thing is in Merda, first of all, because Merda, if you come to Merda and you look how the geography of Merda, how we got surrounded by how the village surrounded by the Israeli, by the occupation. So from south we have Ariel, the settlement of Ariel is the biggest one in West Bank. From the north side we have Fence. So all the village is like a small jail. So we have only one entrance. So the soldiers, they could close the entrance any minute they want, and so we'll be in the jail, so we can't leave, we can't go anywhere. Even the main street, we used to have like small entrances to reach our fields. Now we have no chance because they close the fence, so we have the fence, so you have no chance to go to your field. If we have the project here, I'm going to encourage the people, no, stuck in your land, grow your field and don't leave. Because, you know, when you have more pressure, you're supposed to leave, you prefer to leave to find another chance for life instead of staying under all this pressure like this. So that's my aim or my fight against the occupation.
Do you think it's a more positive fight than lots of demonstrations?
There's different struggle. Yeah. So some people, they struggle by demonstration or by shooting or a strike or something, but my fight is by growing our own vegetables or our own fruit, so we more independent. As you know, the economy is the most dangerous weapons in the world. So if we build our economy here, like especially like, let's say about in the village itself, if we have the whole farmers start on planting their own fruits. And we are farmers anyway. I mean, we're not like living in the city. So it's us, our own job, or it's my parents' or my grandparents' job. That's what they was doing did in the past years. So we can encourage them to do it again.
So your family have always been in Marda?
Yeah, since ever. We live in this village.
When you went to America, what did you miss most about Marda?
Marda? Yeah, I miss the whole village. I'm like... I don't know how they say this. They call me this is called like homesick. Yeah. So I never cry in my life. But when I get there, anytime I mention the village, I start crying. Like now.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Do you get any help from any permaculture projects from outside of Palestine?
No, it's like not like from permaculture projects. Now I'm a membership with the Permaculture Institute in England, and I'm a membership with the Global Village Europe side, and I'm going to be registered as a branch or as a foreign NGOs from GVI for GVI, Global Village Institute in America. So now we have some fund from different places, like from UK, through UK people, or through the Bristol group, the Zaytuna group. So they help us a lot by funding the tools sometimes, and they did the Christmas card gifts. So we have some fund. It's not a lot, but it's okay. And like as example, like this workshop, we got funded through Starhawk. The one, she got deported by the Israeli. She came here to run the workshop here, but unfortunately she got deported. She got arrested for 2 days at the airport, and they deport her back to America. And that's why we have the new two instructors. They are from Canada, and they have a project in Jordan. So we sent an urgent call through the internet, and we have this nice response from these two guys. We got many response from different people, but we finally get these two guys, and we're really lucky to have them here.
Does Israel interfere with your work.
Yeah. As example, a few weeks, they cut the wire, the fence. They cut the fence just to go through. They could go, if they keep walking, they have the path to walk. But they cut the wire and they go through the site. And sometimes they come around the area, so I can't come to the site sometimes because they stop people coming to this area for many reasons in their opinion. And maybe if they, like today, if we have a workshop, if they close the gate so nobody can get in, so this will affect. That's one of the things they could do it. And they come to the village a lot, most every day, like last night, like every week, every day they come. They occupy three houses for three times. Every time they occupy the house, the roof of the house, and they stay for one day, sometimes for 2 days or for 3 days. So this is more pressure on the people. Nobody can move. Nobody can go anywhere. Nobody can do his work, his own job. Like for me, as you see, we have the site in the middle of the village mostly, but it's not in the village, but next to the village. So if I had to go from my house to the site, I had to go through the village. So if I have the army there, I had to go back home, so I can't go to my site to regate my plants or my trees. And it's the incubation. So what we can do.
So when they occupy a house, are they putting snipers on the roof of the house?
Of course, yeah. They have their snipers. They put their own flag, and they put their tent, and they were shooting from the roof against the kids and the people because they come around surrounding the people. They surround the houses, and they ask them to leave, but they start shooting gas and bomb sound and rubber bullets. And as example, I have my nephew. He's 16 years old, and that day we was under curfew. So he was in the village, so when he heard this, he tried to go back home, because they said it's under curfew. So the jeep stopped him, and there was four soldiers standing. One of them told him, go back. He said, I'm going home. He didn't know, go back. So when he turned his back, tried to go back where he come from, they shoot him with three bullets in his back, about 3 meter distance. Just like that, they want to play games. They shoot him three bullets, rubber bullets, I mean, in his back, and they just left. So it's a danger area here.
When did that happen?
It's about 3 weeks ago.
So your nephew was shot in the back three times?
Three bullets in one time from three soldiers. They stand next to each other, and they just shoot him in the back from 3 meter distance, not from away. He didn't try to run. He didn't try to do anything. They asked him to leave, so he tried to leave. But they shoot him in his back, just like this.
And how is he now?
He's okay. It's rubber bullets. He got bent. He got like... they took him to the hospital. They cut. They do operation for him, and he's okay now. He still have some pain, but he's okay.
This kind of behavior by soldiers, is it common?
I'll not be surprised from the soldiers or from the occupation. They could do anything they want.
So why are they occupying your village?
They occupy the whole country, not just my village. So Merda is in Palestine, and the Palestine itself is occupied by the Israeli. So the whole country occupied, not just my village.
I mean, why do they invade? What do they want from the village?
I think they want us to leave. Like, as you remind me, like a few years ago, when we used to have the first project, we have a volunteer day from the foreign students from Beer Zeit University. So they come to the village, to the site, and we walk for the whole day. And in their program, they have a visit. They have to visit a real settlement. So I went with them. So I was between the foreign students and the settlers or the police there. They did not recognize me. So I went there with them. And they have in their program an interview with the mayor, Ron Nachman. His name is Ron Nachman, the mayor of Ariel. So there was talk with him. After a while, like we have many discussion with the mayor about the place where they're going to sit. Then finally we have a place, and they sit together and they start talking with him, questioning him. So the funny thing is that there's a British guy, he asked him a question. He told him, okay, you live in this settlement, look, it's like a part of Europe. And if you go down, if you look just down from your window and you see that village there, they have no water, it's like a desert. So what's going on? Why? What's the big difference between you and them? So why you have these things here? He said, they are not Palestinian, because he told him what about the Palestinian people. He told him they are not Palestinian. He told him, what you mean they're not Palestinian? So what they are? He said, I don't know. They come from somewhere, and they had to go where they come from. So everybody started laughing at the mayor because he had this thinking. And for me, I'm not surprised, because I know Ron Nachman, he's the chief for the whole settlements in West Bank. So he's like a, I could say he's a Nazi or is or he's racist or something like that. So he's an enemy. So in their belief, we have to, in their belief or in their thinking or what they try to do for the country, to they're gonna force the people to leave the whole area. And especially if you drive through the country, you see how they separate each town from the other town or from city, each city from the other city. They have this, the wall, they build the wall, they have fence. So we are, like all the country, we live in jail. You could say it's a prison. So each village is like a small prison or a big prison. So that's the situation for the whole country.
Alice Gray, and Alice Gray has been working on environmental projects in Palestine since 2006. Alice, how did you come to work on environmental projects in the West Bank?
Well, I'd finished my degree. I have 2 degrees in ecology and environmental science that I got from universities in Britain. And I wanted to go out and apply some of what I'd learned. And I found an environmental NGO called the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem that's based in Bethlehem. And I emailed them. And they offered me to come and work for them as a researcher, which I did for about a year. Before I left and founded another NGO with some people, which is called Life Source, which is focused on like the water issues here.
What are some of the water issues inside the West Bank?
Well, there are many environmental issues in the West Bank, but the water issue is perhaps like one of the most important because, as we know, like water is life. Water is essential for almost every aspect of life, not just human life, but the environmental life as well. And like many other aspects of the environment, the water resources and their development are not under the control of the Palestinians. They're actually under the control of Israel. And Israel prevents Palestinian water development and also allots Palestinians an unequal share of the resources, and this causes them huge problems. In addition, they prevent Palestinians from practicing decent environmental management, basically, on many levels. The environment is extremely political here, basically. Every aspect of the environment is political.
How does Israel interfere?
Okay, this really goes back to the Oslo Agreement. Like, prior to the Oslo Agreement, during the occupation, Israel had declared itself, one, the owner of all Palestinian water resources, and two, they'd taken over administration. Okay, there was no Palestinian government. There was no Palestinian administration. They'd got rid of the Jordanian administration and replaced it with an Israeli administration that did not care about the Palestinian environment, but they also completely forbade the Palestinians from taking control themselves. Now, after Oslo, like, certain powers were handed over, but it was never comprehensive. Like, I don't think that you can really talk about justice or freedom without talking about environmental justice and the freedom to, like, manage your environment. Because without those things, it really doesn't mean very much. If you have no water, you have no life. If you have no ability to, like, manage your rubbish or your wastewater or your sewage, then you have a huge problem because your towns start to degenerate and turn into places that are quite unfit for humans to live in. And this is what is happening all over Palestine now. And if your environment becomes poisoned, you can't grow food. If you can't grow food, you can't feed yourselves, and you become entirely a dependent people, which is not a viable state, which is exactly what we're seeing in Palestine now. So basically, Israel, when they made the Oslo Agreement, they did not hand over control over most resources. They retained it for themselves. They split the land up into areas A, B, and C, and this is really a key thing because Area C currently accounts for at least 60% of the West Bank, whereas areas A and B account for 40%, and they're nearly all built-up areas. Now, in order to exercise decent environmental management, you'd need control over a lot more than 40% of the land. Basically, you cannot build a decent water network, you cannot build a sewage network, you can't build sewage treatment plants, you can't build sanitary landfills inside a town. Like, this is not the idea. This is, like, no one builds a sanitary landfill in the middle of a city. They would want to build them in Area C. Now, there's a huge problem. Like, there's a permitting process you have to go through in order to build anything in Area C. And in general, permits are not, like, really issued by Israel. And all Palestinian managers, like environmental managers, the Palestinian Water Authority, the Palestinian Ministry of the Environment, are saying, we can't be effective. We can't do our jobs. In fact, what we're relegated to is just being a big NGO. Like, this is what a Palestinian Water Authority official actually said to me the other day. We're nothing but a big NGO because we don't have the remit to really do our job because we're not in control. We don't control 60% of the land. How can we build a water network? The whole idea is to transport water around the country. Like, you have to build pipelines between the towns when all the land between the towns is owned by Israel. How can we build a sewage treatment plant? We're not given permits to build them. We don't get to see the settlement master plan. Now, the settlement expansion is, like, all over Area C. The Palestinians don't even know what the settlement expansion master plan is. So when they apply to the Israeli civil authority and say, please, can we have a permit to build a sanitary landfill? Please, can we have a permit to build a sewage treatment plant? The civil authority are often going to say, no, you can't, because it interferes with our plan. The Ministry of Settlements will say no. The Ministry of Defense will say, no, it's a security risk, we won't have it. They have, like, very few permits really being issued for these things, and it's a massive problem. What you see now is that there's only one sewage treatment plant in the whole of the West Bank. It's in El Bira. 90% of the sewage is being discharged into the environment. There's 2.3 million people here. Like, one sewage treatment plant is not enough. But there's millions of dollars in international aid that's backed up because they can't really get the permits to implement projects. It's a huge problem. And, like, the landfill problem, this is another huge problem. Like, there's a massive just rubbish dumps all over the place that are not properly managed. But it's really a problem to get control of these things. And the other problem that there has been repeatedly in a lot of towns is that under curfew, the rubbish trucks, the municipal rubbish trucks, can't get through to pick up the rubbish, and they can't get to the sanitary landfills because there's a whole series of roadblocks and checkpoints that are getting in the way. So what happens? People just burn their rubbish, and they have massive air pollution. It causes huge health problems. But the other thing that's very short-sighted about this entire policy is that not only does it really harm the Palestinian population, which you may say the Israelis, like, they just don't care about that, and it may even, like, some would posit, be like a sort of side intention to harm the Palestinian population through these means, although that's an open debate. it's also very short-sighted because this is a small country and all of these things will ultimately impact on the Israeli population. Like, air pollution is not localized to Palestinian towns. If there's massive air pollution, it will blow into like nearby Israeli settlements and indeed over the border into Israel. If there is pollution, this population is heavily reliant on groundwater that underlies the West Bank. In addition, the Israeli population are heavily reliant on groundwater that underlies the West Bank for at least 25% of their water supply. If that water becomes contaminated, it will also harm the Israeli population. But essentially, at the moment, we just have a kind of gridlock where nothing's happening, and there are these man-made environmental catastrophes that are harming the Palestinians first, but they will come home to roost and harm the Israeli population as well.
So what do you see as the future for the environment in this land that was formerly Palestine and is now a mixture of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, settlements A, B and C?
Well, I think that the Palestinians, of all the people in the world, have to be the most innovative. Like, if there's ever a country that requires to really think about sustainable development, truly sustainable, like, how do you live without destroying the environment around you? How can you, like, essentially live in a tight cycle where you don't generate huge amounts of rubbish, where you take care of your sewage, where you can grow food like on few resources and you can deal with like shortage of water? It's Palestine. It's a man-made need, but it's also a global problem. As we all know, like, there's a global issue of population growth, there's a global issue of climate change, there's a global water crisis, and all of these things are likely to escalate in the next 50 years. Now, in Palestine, the need has been created right now to come up with solutions to this problem. And I think very much that we're not seeing political solutions. We're not seeing politicians really stepping up and dealing with these problems. They have created a system that, between themselves, they're making no progress. They're gridlocked. But what does that leave us with? It leaves us with the grassroots in Palestine. It leaves us with the demand for direct action that actually deals with the environment, that, like, essentially, we're here today on a permaculture course. Now, this could become very important. The Palestinian economy is collapsing. If people can learn to grow food, like in the small scraps of land that are left to them, in a way that is completely sustainable, that would be an amazing boost for Palestine. I think that in Israel as well, we're seeing an environmental movement that's increasingly disenchanted with the government and increasingly trying to take matters into their own hands. In some cases, we're seeing a hopeful development where Israelis and Palestinians are realizing that they are living in a shared environment and that it's like each of their responsibility, like what one does impacts the other. And that, in fact, their future is a shared one, and they're trying to like build bridges to work together and share their knowledge and understand how to live in this land without destroying it. I think it's very hopeful that this grassroots movements are happening, because we're really not seeing much move from this on the government. In fact, like during the Annapolis conference, the environment was scarcely on the agenda. Like, the water issue was not discussed at all, and land issues were not discussed. Everything is very ensnared in the other political issues that are going on here. But in fact, the environment is perhaps the most important political issue of all, because the environment describes people's ability to have a decent life, to live, and to like have a healthy life. And it's essential, essential to the viability of human life in this area, essential to the future of both the Palestinian and the Israeli populations.
Palestinians have to take responsibility when the world isn't allowing them to take responsibility. So it has to be at a grassroots level that people start doing stuff for themselves. But there's a huge amount of interference in day-to-day life here. So what's going to have to happen with the amount of interference that the population, the Palestinian population, suffers from the occupation?
Well, I think that it's a huge problem. And to give an example, Palestinians may want to like invest in rainwater harvesting, like as an option to increase their water supply. Now, the Israeli occupation actually like forbids Palestinians from building rainwater harvesting systems, and quite frequently have destroyed rainwater harvesting systems that Palestinians have built. Now, this is a huge problem, because we're saying that we need this grassroots movement. And you're right, there is an entire system that's set up to try to squash it. And the solutions against that need to be innovative. There needs to be like persistence and tenacity in the face of like all of these odds. But in addition, there's a real need for like advocacy on behalf of Palestinians in this, because quite clearly Israel, as in many things, is in contravention of international law. Now, there should be mechanisms to basically criticize the Israeli government. And this is some of the like positive effect of the sort of cross-border cooperations that we're seeing, because some Israelis are starting to attack their own government for these policies, which they've started to recognize are actually really destructive for them. But I think like under the current system, it's still possible for Palestinians to do things. It's not easy at all. And I think that all the grassroots practical actions need to be in tandem with really strong advocacy, in certain cases with litigation and legal action, to really bring this into the spotlight. Because, I mean, as I said earlier, if you interfere with people's ability to manage their environment, you're interfering with their ability to have a decent life. And this is really, really important. If you take water from someone, you take their life, really. And that these like systems and power dynamics that are actually creating human suffering and environmental destruction are challenged. And challenged on several tracks at the same time, challenged by encouraging grassroots action, encouraging people to think, no, I as an individual have the power to make change. I as an individual affect my environment. I can take control of how I impact the environment, and I'm going to choose to do it in a responsible and sustainable way. And also, it needs to be recognized that there's a systematic destruction going on. There's a power structure in place here that is essentially against that, and is threatening to bring ruin to all the people of the region. And that really needs to be challenged. It needs to be challenged by Palestinians, it needs to be challenged by Israelis, and it needs to be challenged internationally, because it is, as I've stated, against international law. It's quite clearly stated in international law and the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights that people have the right to take care of their own needs, and that it's illegal to interfere with that.
I look around when I come to this land, and it seems to me that the Palestinian farmers have quite a good relationship with their land. I see a lot of olive growing. I see quite a positive relationship, and things like the terracing that happens here shows a really good understanding of their environment.
I think that the Palestinian farming sector, the agricultural sector, has suffered more than any other sector, like under the occupation. If you look at the historic changes in this place, the land closures, the land seizures, the denial of the right to water, the denial of the right to build or rehabilitate wells, all of these things have impacted farmers so hard. There are so many things that are against them. And I think it's correct to say that fellaheen culture, you're right, has their traditional agriculture has been quite in harmony with the land, or at least they have like practiced a sort of agriculture that is suited to this region, which I could say is like, the Zionist paradigm was not to do that. The Zionist paradigm was to bring a very modern agriculture here, and the one that required very high inputs of water and fertilizers, which is a problem that Israel is dealing with internally at the moment. There are certainly like questions being raised about that in Israel, and there's like changes happening. But Palestinian farmers, I think they have the potential to farm really responsibly, and I think that there is a tradition of doing that. At the same time, the odds are really, really heavily stacked against them at the moment, and I'm very much afraid that they're a dying breed, because they're losing their land like inch by inch and dunam by dunam. The wall is taking it from them, the closures are taking it from them, the settlers are taking it from them, and this is a massive problem. You know, they're priced out of the market by high water prices that they can't afford when Israeli farmers receive subsidies. In addition, the Israeli farming market are having sort of free access to the Palestinian market so that they can undercut Palestinian farmers' prices. And this is causing a huge problem for Palestinian farmers. Whereas I can say, like, in contradiction of that, at the same time, because of the economic collapse, there's a massive pressure on people to return to some form of subsistence farming, because there's really high unemployment and really high poverty rate, so that if people can produce their own food, that's really positive. But again, there's that pressure, The odds are stacked against them. Palestinians, more than anyone, need to be so innovative in order to meet this challenge that's being put on them.
Thank you very much. Could you tell me the website of your NGO, LifeSource? Could you tell me, if people want to look at what you're doing inside the West Bank, what is your website?
Our website is www.thelifesourceproject.org. It's currently being updated, but we hope to relaunch it very, very soon. And yes, please do check in for more information about the water situation. Thanks.
It's not working. Do you want to leave an email for listeners?
Yep, sure. Our email, if you have any questions at all, is info@thelifesourceproject.org. LifeSource is spelled LifeSource. And yeah, it's all one word. So info@thelifesourceproject.org. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Okay, so first of all, what's your name?
Thomas Pearson.
And what are you doing in the West Bank, Thomas?
I live in Beit Sahour, and there with a group of friends, Palestinians and internationals, we're working to construct a permacultural model. It's going to be an organic farm, incorporating what we can observe of the local ecosystem. And working with that, we aim to demonstrate to farmers how you can increase your yield without any greater capital input and without using more area.
How did you come to work in Palestine?
I was travelling overland from England to Africa, and I had some friends in the West Bank who I'd been meaning to visit for several years. So I crossed from Jordan and I decided to stay here for a year, if permitted.
So you're now working on a permaculture project in Beit Sahour?
That's right, yeah. It's called Bustan Karaka, which means the tortoise garden, because when we first acquired the site, we realised there was an abundance of tortoises on the land, which are extremely endangered elsewhere. But this is a real little population hotspot. So, and also, it's non-political and doesn't use any family names, so it seemed like a fresh and memorable name.
So that's Arabic for tortoise. Could you say it again for me?
Unfortunately, I pronounce it terribly because it's got the letter Ayn towards the end and I can't pronounce it. But it's Bustan is garden and Karaka is tortoise. And I really like that word because it's not, it's the very local vernacular for tortoise. It's not even used throughout the West Bank, just in the South West Bank. And that's another important thing about what we're trying to do. It's, you know, we want to keep it local. It's all about local involvement, using local species with the local environment. So, yeah, to use a word out of the local dialect, I think is a good idea.
So what are your biggest challenges that you're facing right now?
There's a conflict between actually having enough money to eat and still having time to work on the project. I've been dedicating myself to the project and it means I've been going hungry, basically. That's my biggest challenge. It's finding a balance between supporting myself and keeping the project going in these early stages before we really formally exist. It's difficult to sort of attract the funding at this point.
So what are you doing currently to build the project?
Right now, we're just signing the lease on the land. And from that point, we will be, once we know we have the site, we're raising awareness locally by hosting hundreds of school children over the coming weeks, and we'll be dealing with issues, particularly littering, which is a big problem because the Palestinians don't have the facility to deal with their own rubbish. It's just mounting up right now. They can't recycle, they can't bury, they can't burn it, they've nowhere to put it. So we're showing ways to use it. We're also having open days with the local farmers so we can introduce ourselves before they form their own opinions of us, which they will inevitably, but we'd like to have a word from the outset. They will come to us and we will explain what we're about and let them know that it's their site as much as it is anybody else's. It's always going to be an open site, so anybody can come onto it at any time and check out what we're doing.
So the project is going to be for lots of children in Beit Zahura to visit, lots of foreign children, all sorts of children.
And adults alike. We, principally those who we aim for the project to benefit most immediately and directly are the local farmers. What we want to... We have the luxury of taking risks on our land because we don't have a family depending upon us. So we can have a lot of... We can have experimental crops and we can trial new techniques like things like different densities, irrigation regimes, varieties, plant combinations, which the other farmers don't have the luxury for that experimentation. So the whole community will learn with us through coming to the site and seeing what we're doing, and they will judge with their own eyes what's a success and what's not. It's not about telling people what to do, it's about learning with them.
And what's your favourite story from the project so far?
I don't really know what kind of the answer.
What's your favourite memory of experience of the project so far?
I guess probably one of the happiest moments was after a frustrating day trying to coordinate the international volunteers and get materials to build goat exclosures for some trees we were planting so they weren't immediately grazed to death by the goats. And it was a hot afternoon and everybody disappeared off and left me to do it by myself. And then the lads came down from the village on the hill and been watching us work on the land, and we got the whole job finished that evening. Just me and them, which is exactly how we want it to continue into the future. It's not about internationals coming to Palestine to indulge their interests, but working as part of the local community.
So what's going to be the future, you hope?
Well, hopefully the site will evolve over time. We'll be able to refine what we're doing. It'll become gradually more productive. And also we want to branch off into lots of other projects, for example, working on other people's land. Right now we're active on three sites. Bustan Karaka is our base, but we always want to be working in the wider community, advising and from the experience we gain on our site, sharing that with others.
You said that you travelled across Africa, but you ended up working in the West Bank. What made you decide to work in the West Bank rather than Africa, parts of Africa?
Well, I was travelling from Britain to Africa. So I went across Europe and then down through Turkey and the Middle East, and I've travelled so far as Palestine. And at some point when I decide to leave here, or I'm prevented from re-entering, then at that point I will continue down to Africa. The thing is, I've nothing very specific planned there, so I'm taking advantage of like the good energy and the opportunity here now to participate in a project that I believe in.
Thank you very much.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Centre, imemc.org, from March the 22nd through to March the 28th, 2008. Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas agree on a national reconciliation deal, while this week the Israeli army attacks on Gaza leave 5 Palestinians dead. These stories and more coming up, stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the non-violent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Conscience Lunders with the details. On Friday, scores of residents from Belayin, a village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, took to the streets along with their international and Israeli supporters to conduct their weekly non-violent protest against the Israeli war and illegal confiscation of the village land. Israeli troops manning the wall and the gate that cuts off the villages from their land showered the protesters with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets immediately after the protesters reached the gate. 17 were injured, including 7 journalists. Iyad Banat of the Belayin Popular Committee was among those injured.
As we arrived at the gate in the wall, soldiers showered us with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. They tried to kidnap one of the village youth. As I went to help him, they attacked and beat me up very badly.
The parents of Rachel Corrie, an American peace activist who was killed in Gaza by the Israeli army 5 years ago, joined the Belayin protest. At least 250 Palestinians from the village of Al-Khada, located near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem, joined by Israeli and international peace activists, staged a protest at midday on Friday against the illegal wall Israel is building on the village land. The protest commenced with Friday prayers held at the Anasha Israeli checkpoint, located at the entrance to the village. Members of the local popular committee of land defence in Al-Khada and the village mayor delivered speeches in Arabic. The protests ended peacefully without any clashes with the army. Samar Jabba from the local popular committee of lands defence in Al-Khada talked to IMEMC.
Today was one of the actions to celebrate 32nd anniversary of Palestinian Land Day. Through this demonstration, we tried to send a message to the international world to put the pressure over Israeli occupation to stop violate the basic Palestinian rights.
In Bethlehem on Friday, 150 residents of the Masara village were joined by around 30 international and Israeli peace activists who gathered in the yard of a local school and then marched to village lands that were at risk from confiscation due to the construction of the annexation wall. Israeli soldiers deployed near village land, installed barbed wire and prevented protesters from reaching the site. A group of children attempted to reach the area by going up the hills, but Israeli soldiers fired at them, injuring two. Both are 9 years old. The theme of the march was the 32nd anniversary of Land Day and was a protest against Israeli acts of land confiscation for construction of the wall and the expansion of nearby settlements. On March 30, 1976, Palestinians voiced their rejection of the Israeli policies of racism and annexation of Palestinian lands in demonstrations in the Arab town of Sakhnin in the Galilee. On that day, 6 Palestinian residents of Sakhnin were killed by the Israeli police. Palestinians and Arabs have been commemorating the date since then. For IMEMC.org, this is Conscience Londres. This week, the rival Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah agreed to a reconciliation deal in the Yemeni capital of Sana'a. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups met with Egyptian officials to discuss a possible truce with Israel. This and more with IMEMC's Eliza Sprout.
The Yemeni brokered reconciliation deal between Hamas and Fatah was signed by representatives of both parties. However, each side has its own interpretation of the deal. The Hamas spokesperson in Gaza, Fawzi Barhoum, told IMEMC that Hamas is committed to the provisions of the truce deal with the rival Fatah party.
Provisions of the Yemeni initiative are clear enough. The Yemeni initiative marks a framework for a dialogue between Hamas and Fatah that would return the situation back in both Gaza and the West Bank prior to June 2007. This means there are no preconditions and any outcome of such a dialogue will be respected by Hamas.
Meanwhile, a spokesman of the Palestinian president, Nabil Abu Rudena, announced that the deal is invalid until Hamas renounces control over the Gaza Strip. Fuad Kukali, a Fatah MP in the West Bank, told the IMEMC that Fatah is concerned about the unity among the Palestinians.
The government is not the important. What is important are the unity of the Palestinian people and the unity of the Palestinian performance in the negotiations in front of the entire world, Israel and America. What we need is a unified Palestinian position with a clear vision that we can convince our friends, partners and the whole world with.
In Gaza, hundreds of members of civil society organizations and clan chiefs rallied in Gaza City, calling on both factions to reconcile their differences and end their power struggle for the good of the national interests. Speaking to IMEMC, Samir Zaukat, a member of the Gaza Mental Health Program, considered unity as an imperative for the Palestinian people.
The rally is a message to all Palestinian forces, especially the leadership of Fatah and Hamas, that the Palestinian people and the ordinary people who have been abandoned by all want unity.
On another issue, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas confirmed during a meeting in Amman with Jordan's monarch, King Abdullah II, that current negotiations with Israel are tackling all outstanding issues, including Jerusalem. The same remark was echoed earlier in the week by Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni during an interview with Israel's TV Channel 2. In the meantime, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was quoted this week as saying that there will be a peace deal with Palestinians by the end of 2008 and that talks will continue. Olmert also warned of further military strikes against the ruling Hamas party in the Gaza Strip, excluding a ceasefire deal. On a more pessimistic note, senior Palestinian negotiator Saya Berikat reiterated a warning of the Palestinian Authority's imminent collapse during a meeting this week with the Foreign Minister of Luxembourg in the West Bank city of Jericho. Berikat cited slowness of peace talks as well as continued Israeli construction of settlements. Palestinian Minister Salam Fayyad voiced a similar concern this week in a meeting with Israeli Defence Minister Ehud Barak. US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected to arrive in the region on Friday in a visit that will last until next Sunday, aimed at encouraging both Israelis and Palestinians to make a peace deal by Washington's deadline, which is the end of 2008. Vice President of the United States Dick Cheney visited Palestine and Israel earlier in the week and also urged Israelis and Palestinians to conclude an agreement by the end of 2008. Some commentators believe that Cheney's statements during the visit put much of the blame for the lack of progress on the Palestinian side, despite Washington's repeated concerns over Israel's planned settlement building. In Egypt, members of the Hamas and Islamic Jihad parties held a meeting with Egyptian officials on ways to reach a ceasefire with Israel. Hamas insists that Israel should halt actions against Gaza and the West Bank before any ceasefire is concluded. For IMEMC.org, this is Eliza Sprout.
As the Israeli siege on the Gaza Strip continues, Israeli army attacks on the coastal region left 4 Palestinians dead this week. From Gaza, IMEMC's Rami Amagari reports.
A Palestinian resistance fighter of the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, has been reportedly killed by the Israeli army early on a Friday morning. Media sources reported that Israeli army special force clashed with a group of fighters near the Qassafi military post to the east of Al-Qarara village in the southern Gaza Strip. During the fighting, Bilal Al-Asr, 23, was killed. Israeli army tanks and bulldozers invaded the village of Al-Qarara in the southern part of the Gaza Strip on Wednesday night. Tanks and bulldozers destroyed 2 homes owned by local farmers, in addition to bulldozing 50 dunams of farmland, local sources reported. A Palestinian resistance fighter was pronounced dead on Wednesday at midday of wounds sustained during an Israeli attack targeting the Gaza Strip 3 weeks ago. Mohammed Abid Rabo, 24, was injured earlier this month during Israeli attacks when the army killed at least 130 Palestinians. 95 of them were civilians. Jazia Abu Hilal, 65, from Gaza City, died on Tuesday night from a chronic illness. For several months, she was prevented by the army from leaving Gaza to obtain life-saving treatment, doctors said. Death of Abu Hilal brings the number of Palestinians dead due to being denied permission to leave Gaza for medical care to 118, according to medical sources in the Palestinian coastal region. The Israeli army has placed Gaza under total siege since June 2007. The Israeli army shot and killed a Palestinian farmer on Monday at midday in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Yusuf Abu Thayer was working his land located close to the southern border between Israel and Gaza near the city of Khan Yunis when Israeli troops from a nearby army post opened fire, killing the 55-year-old man. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mirari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli army conducted at least 48 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. During these attacks, Israeli troops kidnapped 82 Palestinian civilians, including 15 children. IMEMC's Manal Jabrin with the details.
With 82 civilians kidnapped this week, the number of Palestinian civilians kidnapped by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of 2008 has mounted to 777. The Israeli army attacked 2 radio stations in the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Tuesday. Witnesses said that troops searched and ransacked the offices of Al-Hurriya and Siraj radio stations, then kidnapped radio technician from Siraj Radio. Abdul Jabbar Abu Sneneh, the owner of Siraj Radio, explains.
أعداد كبيرة جدا من قوات.
An Israeli force attacked and searched the office of Siraj and Al-Hurriya radios. They confiscated broadcasting equipment, troops detained the staff, then beat up some of them. In addition, the soldiers kidnapped our colleague in Siraj radio, Ahmed Sunnukrut.
Also in the southern part of the West Bank, a group of Israeli settlers from the illegal settlement of Havat Ma'un opened fire at Palestinian shepherds and their sheep on Wednesday midday. Shepherds from a Tuwane village near the settlement were grazing their sheep when Israeli settlers opened fire at them and injured three sheep. Settlers from the same settlement attacked two farmers from a Tuwane village in another incident on Friday and injured them both. The farmer and his son were detained by the Israeli police, who arrived at the location of the attack and then took one of the farmers to a nearby military post. For AMIMC.org, this is Manar Jibrin. And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. This is Louisa White and Ghassan Bonora.